Welcome to the Sufi Reverberations podcast, where each week, God willing, you will be able to hear a poem, a story, a meditation, and a musical interlude that give expression to one Sufi's perspective concerning the mystical dimension of Islam. My name is Anab Whitehouse, and I will be your host. Although I am not a sheikh, nonetheless, I did have the opportunity to spend 16 years in the company of a Sufi saint of the 20th century, and by the grace of God, was able to gain a few insights into the nature of the Sufi mystical path through that association. So, without further delay, let's proceed to the essential contents of this episode. The wine is from that world, the vessels from this. The vessels are seen, but the wine is hidden. Hidden indeed from the sight of the carnal, but open and manifest to the spiritual. O God, our eyes are blinded. O pardon us, our sins are a heavy burden. Thou art hidden from us, though the heavens are filled with thy light, which is brighter than sun and moon. Thou art hidden, yet revealest our hidden secrets. Thou art the source that causes our rivers to flow. Thou art hidden in thy essence, but seen by thy bounties. Thou art like the water, and we like the millstone. Thou art like the wind, and we like the dust. The wind is unseen, but the dust is seen by all. Thou art the spring, and we the sweet green garden. Spring is not seen, though its gifts are seen. Thou art as the soul, we as hand and foot. Soul instructs hand and foot to hold and take. Thou art as reason, we like the tongue. 'Tis reason that teaches the tongue to speak. Thou art as joy, and we are laughing. The laughter is the consequence of the joy. Our every motion, every moment testifies, for it proves the presence of the everlasting God. So the revolution of the millstone so violent testifies to the existence of a stream of water. O thou who art above our conceptions and descriptions, dost be on our heads and upon our similitudes of thee. Yet thy slaves never cease devising images of thee. They cry to thee alway, my life is thy footstool. Like that shepherd who cried, O Lord, come nigh to thy faithful shepherd, that he may cleanse thy garment of vermin, and mend thy shoes and kiss the hem of thy robe. No one equaled that shepherd in love and devotion, though his manner of expressing it was most faulty. His love pitched its tent on the heavens. He himself was as the dog at the tent door. When the sea of love to God boiled up, it touched his heart, but it touches your eyes and ears only. You have been listening to an excerpt from Book 5 of Jalaluddin Rumi's Mathnawi, translated and abridged by E. H. Winfield. The title of today's short story is Humble Beginnings. A man lived in the countryside and had two donkeys, whom he loved. He had been given the animals when he was a boy in order to help him learn to be responsible. But what had begun as a parental exercise with respect to the child had been transformed into a lifelong labor of service, caring, and affection for the animals. As a boy, he had fed them, groomed them, and nursed them back to health the few times they had become ill or had injured themselves somehow while traveling about in the countryside. This loving care had continued into adulthood, both with respect to the boy as well as the donkeys. In their own way, the two donkeys had reciprocated the boy's affectionate attention. They followed the boy everywhere and would quickly do whatever the boy wished in the way of work, although they would be as stubborn as, well, donkeys,
whenever anyone else in the boy's family tried to get them to do tasks on the farm. The townspeople often made jokes about the boy and his donkeys whenever the latter three came into town on this or that errand. However, the boy didn't care what the townspeople said because he knew the joy which his donkeys brought to his heart just by being his constant companions, and because of the gentle, friendly manner through which they responded to his caring for them. As the boy became a young man and the donkeys got older as well, the three of them continued to be inseparable. Human nature being what it is, townspeople who had no insight into the bond between the man and his two donkeys continued to ridicule the young man whenever they got the chance, and some of the townspeople even spread malicious rumors about the young man and his donkeys, rumors which had no basis in truth. One day, a very old man came to town and made arrangements with the officials of the community to give a series of talks about mysticism. These talks were to be free and held in the town square each evening at 8 p.m., and everyone who had interest in the topic of mysticism was invited to attend. Since such talks were a very rare event in the area, and because the people were both curious and somewhat bored with their lives, a great number of townspeople attended the talks. Moreover, since the elderly gentleman was a very knowledgeable and entertaining speaker, each talk was eagerly anticipated by the residents of the community, and whatever was talked about the previous evening became the topic of conversation among the townspeople throughout the next day. On the third or fourth night of talks, as the elderly man was about to rise and begin his talk, the young man who had become known far and wide as the Donkey Man came into the heart of town crying and loudly lamenting. The young man's grief was so audible that the evening's discussion could not begin, and naturally the townspeople were quite annoyed with the disruption. The elderly man held up his hands and motioned to the audience to be quiet. After the audience calmed down, the older man turned to the younger man and asked him to explain, as best he could, what had happened. The young man, in between his sighs and tears, was able to explain that his donkeys had been missing for several days. Moreover, despite all his efforts, he had not been able to find them and feared the worst concerning them, and then he began to cry again. The townspeople, who had been silent throughout the young man's story, more out of respect for the speaker than the donkey man, now erupted with impatience and disdain concerning the interloper. Some of them began to make sarcastic remarks concerning the young man and his donkeys. The speaker studied the crowd for a moment and then gazed at the young man in a strange way for a few seconds. Finally, he raised his hands again and asked the audience to be quiet. Eventually, they complied with his request. The old man addressed the young man and said, "Son, if you will take a seat, I have just a few words to say to the people here, and then we will try to see if we can help you with your problem. Will that be okay?" The young man nodded his head in the affirmative and took the seat which had been pointed out by the speaker. Though tears continued to flow from his eyes, the young man did his best to keep the noise of his crying muffled. The speaker returned his attention to the rest of the audience and began to talk. "Ladies and gentlemen, first, I must start by saying that tonight is my last talk. Other duties require me to travel elsewhere in the morning." The news was received with dismay by the townspeople, for in just a few short days they had become very interested in what the man had to say, and as well many of them were attracted to his kind demeanor and friendliness. Some of the people protested and begged him to stay on, if only for a few more days. The old man smiled in a rather rueful manner at the crowd's response and indicated, "As much as I would like to stay, I really cannot. However, I do hope to return, at some point in the near future. And perhaps such a possibility will serve as some consolation to those of you who might wish me to remain for a while longer. The speaker's words seemed to mollify the townspeople somewhat, for the audience gradually settled down. They waited for him to speak again. He said, "Tonight's talk is a very short one, but it goes to the very essence of all that I have been discussing the last few nights. Perhaps the best way for me to introduce this topic is to ask you a question." He was silent for a moment as his eyes surveyed the audience. Then he asked, "How many of you have ever been in love? I don't mean liking, or being affectionate, or lusting, or having acquaintances, or being amenable with one another. I mean real love." The members of the audience became preoccupied with the question. Although most of the people listening to the talk had been searching for love all of their lives, many of them were not even sure what it was they were seeking, just that there was some sort of absence or something missing in their lives. And the word which often was used to describe the quality that was not present was love. The speaker let them reflect on his question for a few moments, and then asked the same question again, but in a more emphatic way. "Who here has ever really been in love? Please, raise your hands." A minute or so passed, and finally a few scattered hands went up, somewhat tentatively. The speaker nodded knowingly as he scanned the audience, and finally he indicated that the people with raised arms should lower them. The elderly man said, "I have a suggestion for the rest of you who have not raised your hands in response to my query about love. My suggestion is for you to befriend this young man who has been crying about his donkeys, because he may well know more about love than almost anyone in this gathering. He knows about the joys of the wonderfully expansive feelings that love brings to life, and he knows about the service, longing, worries, compassion, value, sacrifices, acceptance, and meaning inherent in love. If any of you do decide to befriend this young man and learn what he knows about the love he has for his donkeys, then I believe you will benefit greatly from his understanding. He has a wealth of knowledge to share with you, and if you are fortunate, you will begin to put into practice in your own lives and in this community what he has been living for years. I will conclude my talk by saying that perhaps we all could pitch in tomorrow morning before I leave and try to help this young man find his missing donkeys. And if we should not be successful in our hunt, then let us find ways to console him and comfort him." The following edition of Musical Interlude is called Drizzle. from high above the stage at Carnegie Hall, the Royal Albert Hall, and all venues in between, you are listening to the Sufi Reverberations podcast. This week's meditative essay is entitled Yaqeen. There are different kinds and degrees of yaqeen or certainty. Yaqeen is very much tied to the sort of experiences one has had. Consider some of the ways in which an individual might come to learn about, say, one or more of the oceans of the world. There are various degrees of certainty associated with different kinds of knowledge or understanding. For example, let us imagine there is a person who has overheard some puzzling conversations by travelers passing through the region about something called an ocean. These wayfarers even may have described various aspects of this ocean. If the individual does not know the travelers and does not know about oceans, she or he has no way of knowing if they are telling the truth or telling stories. All the person knows is that prior to the overheard conversation, he or she had never encountered such an idea. Next, let us suppose the individual goes to a regional library and begins to look up information on oceans. The person reads a few books on oceanography, sees a variety of photographs of different oceans, and maybe watches an educational film or two about oceans. Certainly, the person now has more information at his or her disposal than before. However, this information still is secondhand and removed from the actual ocean. The individual begins to think a lot about oceans and desires to see one. Consequently, the individual makes arrangements to go on a journey to the ocean described in the library material as being closest to where the person lives. The individual goes on a trip to the ocean and reaches the desired destination. Soon the person is walking along the shore and gazing at the ocean. Let us assume the person eventually comes to a marina where there are boats for rent. The individual is the adventurous sort and decides to take a small boat out on the bay. While rowing or sailing about, the person sees some people in the water engaged in various kinds of activity. Later, after describing the activity to someone on shore, the individual finds out these people were swimming. Swimming seems a rather intriguing thing to do, therefore, after buying the appropriate apparel, the individual proceeds to wade into the water and splash about in the shallows near the shore. During this swimming session, the person comes across some people who are getting ready to go scuba diving. Questions are asked and answers are given. When the individual comes out of the water, someone gives the person a flyer about a school for scuba diving, which has just opened at the marina. Naturally, the individual signs up. After receiving the appropriate instruction, the person rents some equipment and begins seeking someone with whom to dive. As luck would have it, such a person is found and they begin diving at various locations near the marina. During various conversations with the newfound companion, our wayfarer finds out one can go much deeper in the ocean than had been the case on their previous dives. However, different equipment is necessary depending on how far down one wants to go. Having come this far, our wayfarer is not interested in being limited to diving only 100 feet or so beneath the surface. This individual wants to go as deeply into the oceans as possible. The person begins finding out all about deep-sea submergible vehicles. One of the things learned during this period of study is how dangerous such voyages can be, and that only a fool would try to undertake such a project alone. Therefore, the individual sets about trying to find a knowledgeable diver who would be willing to tolerate the ignorance and inexperience of the wayfarer. Not being sure where to look first, the individual goes to the Yellow Pages. The Yellow Pages contain listings for deep-sea telepresence, deep-sea mapping, deep-sea secrets, Deep Sea Advisory Boards, Deep Sea Consultants, Deep Sea Vision, Deep Sea Explorations, Deep Sea Books, Deep Sea Imaging, Deep Sea Mining, Deep Sea Virtual Reality, Deep Sea Resources, Deep Sea Junk, Deep Sea Mysteries, Deep Sea Salvage, Deep Sea Treasures, and quite a few other entries. The individual is confused with all the choices. Eventually, after spending considerable time and effort in checking out various possibilities, and after a few false starts, the individual stumbles across the path of an authentic expert. Fortunately, this expert also has a weakness and compassion for training novices in the area of deep sea diving. The expert nevertheless sets one condition on the arrangement. At some point, the individual must choose between the life on land and the life at sea. The individual spends a number of years learning about submergible vehicles, currents, navigation, and so on under the guidance of the veteran diver. Finally, the time comes for the individual to dive into the depths of the ocean. As the two get prepared for the dive, they are beset by people protesting their proposed venture into the deep. Some of the protesters believe the dive is in contravention of various laws. Others among the protesters believe the resources being assigned to the dive could be put to better use elsewhere. Some of the people fear the dive could upset the balance of nature. Protests notwithstanding, the dive is made. During this dive, the individual sees and witnesses all kinds of incredible, beautiful things which previously had not been conceived of by the individual. The individual reaches a depth which is beyond the scale of the vessel's gauges. Suddenly, there is incredible light all around, where previously there only had been darkness. The light is alive with knowledge, love, and many other qualities as well. The person wonders if this is a symptom of some form of depth psychosis, about which the individual once read. The veteran diver says this is not the case. The person is told something similar happens almost to everyone who reaches this depth, although the precise character of the experience varies with the individual. The wayfarer comes away from this voyage determined to commit the rest of his or her life to being a deep sea diver. The experiences encountered in the depths of the ocean have had a transforming effect on what the individual feels and thinks about the purpose, meaning, value, and significance of life. Moreover, this newfound understanding is not conceptual in nature. It is experiential, direct, and essential. When the two deep sea divers return to land, there are some media people waiting to interview them. These reporters have come to find out both about the controversy created by the encounter between the divers and the protesters, as well as about some rumors concerning their extraordinary experiences during their dive. Most of what transpired during the dive is really beyond description. However, the two divers tried their best to give the media people a sense of what the dive was like. The reporters ask a lot of questions and seem rather skeptical about the story of the two divers. With all due respect to the two individuals, the account of the divers, nonetheless, seems to the reporters to be rather vague, phantasmal, and far-fetched. A number of the media group have advanced degrees of one sort or another. However, none of them has ever done anything more than a little snorkeling. The reporters all feel, based on their years of media experience, quite certain there are ample reasons for not taking the accounts of the divers seriously. Consequently, if they report about the divers at all, the pieces will be treated at best as some sort of entertaining, weird, human interest story and not as hard news. The two divers invite the media people to join them in the next dive as participant observers. The veteran diver indicates one really cannot understand the experiences of deep sea diving unless one undergoes the experiences oneself. Details concerning departure time and so on are given. several of the reporters indicate considerable interest in following up on this invitation. When the time arrives for the next dive, none of the needier people show up. Apparently, the reporters have something else in mind when they speak of investigative reporting. The veteran diver reminds the individual of the conditions set some time ago when the person first came seeking assistance in deep sea diving. More specifically, the individual has to make a choice between the ways of life on land and the ways of life in the ocean depths. The veteran diver points out that now the wayfarer knows what people such as the reporters and those influenced by the reporters think about deep sea diving. The individual is asked, which is more important, the theories, opinions, and conjectures of others concerning experiences which they have never had, or one's own experiences which have been confirmed by an expert in such matters? The wayfarer says the latter is more important. Therefore, the choice of the individual is to opt for the way of life of the ocean depths. The two divers proceed to head out to sea. They again dive to the depths and find it as exhilarating and joyous as the last time. During this voyage, there are many difficulties and problems which arise. As a result of these challenges and tests, the individual comes to learn many important things concerning life, character, and identity. Over the years, a deep bond of love and friendship arises between the two divers. The veteran diver shares a wealth of understanding, knowledge, wisdom, and experience with our wayfarer. Several decades later, there are reports the two have been lost at sea. Some say they are dead. Some say they found a hidden treasure in the deepest part of the ocean. Some say they are in the Bermuda Triangle or aboard the Flying Dutchman. God alone knows the truth of any of these accounts. The disappearance is covered by the same group of media people who interviewed the divers many years earlier. These reporters really don't know anything more concerning the ocean than they did before. Furthermore, they know very little about the lives led or the experiences encountered by the two divers since they last were all together. Nonetheless, at least these reporters had some personal contact with the divers. Therefore, they go about reporting their stories. This is, after all, what they do for a living. Every year, around the time of the reported disappearance, there are public gatherings. These functions commemorate the spirit of commitment and exploration exemplified in the lives of the two divers. On these occasions, learned speakers come and deliver various kinds of addresses. Some of these lectures are based on studies and experiments completed under simulated conditions in the laboratory concerning the lives of deep-sea divers. Some of the speakers talk about their computer models of deep-sea diving. Still others have worked out an impressive array of mathematical equations and formulae which purport to capture the spirit and essence of deep-sea diving. There are some people who commemorate these occasions in a slightly different way. On the basis of a variety of evidence, including eyewitness reports, they feel certain the divers still are alive. Consequently, they organize search parties to go looking for the divers who have disappeared. The travelers, the library, the marina, the boat, the swimmers, the person passing out handbills, the scuba diving school, the scuba divers, the organizations and businesses in the Yellow Pages, the deep-sea divers, the protesters, the media people, the learned scholars, and the search parties all have a relationship with the ocean. All of these relationships are rooted in experiences of one kind or another. Some of these experiences are quite removed from the realities of the ocean. Other experiences come from the ocean depths. Still other experiences fall somewhere in between the foregoing two possibilities. All of the parties feel varying degrees of certainty concerning the truth of their experiences. Some of those who feel certain actually may be correct. Still others not only may be correct, but they actually also may know this to be so. You have been listening to the Sufi Reverberations podcast. I hope you will join me next week for a new episode of this program. May peace be your companion.